attention on this morning is an image of three women who are taken back to fullness through their submission to God. So I'm going to begin with some references to the book of Ruth. Every time I read the Old Testament book of Ruth, I am struck not by the terrible losses suffered by Naomi and Ruth, but instead by God's merciful provisions for these two culturally forsaken women. The book of Ruth is a story of two ladies who, out of desperation, seek a kinsman redeemer and submit themselves humbly to his compassion. But the book of Ruth is also, and perhaps more importantly, the story of a God who transforms their emptiness into fullness. I've experienced devastation in my life, but I've also experienced that transformation from empty despair to fullness. I was invited to speak with you today about my widow's journey from sorrow to peace, and I will do that. But I cannot explain the peace I carry now unless I tell you first about the trauma my children and I suffered last fall. On October 6, 2006, my husband came home from work as usual. Troy had good news about some exciting changes taking shape in his career, some changes that would launch him toward the fulfillment of many personal and professional dreams. I'd been at the grocery store, so he did what a good husband does. He helped me unload the groceries and get them all put away. And then we walked to campus with our kids for homecoming activities. We ate dinner in the Haven. Yes, people who graduate from AU do occasionally come back and eat voluntarily in the Haven. And then we strolled around Helios to talk with friends and some of my former students. The air that night was cool and fragrant. Luminaires flickered along the valley paths as we walked back home. A few hours later, Troy's arm around my shoulder and our boys running ahead of us, kicking leaves and acorns and each other. We planned to take the kids to the homecoming fair the next morning and then to go to the football game. But just after midnight that Friday night, as our children slept upstairs and Troy and I prepared ourselves for bed, his heart suddenly arrested. He stopped breathing, and he died right in front of me. For days, I moved between the hours, asking a single question: how can it be true that my husband is dead? On the morning of Troy's funeral, I wrote the first in a long series of letters, and I'd like to read an excerpt from that first letter to you. Dear Troy, each morning since you died, I have awakened to a deep, perhaps holy, darkness, a darkness where dwells the wounded Christ. I prowl the house, searching for a door so I can leave it. But this darkness is seamless. I find no slips of light to mark the threshold to a brighter room. Yesterday, a woman came to my house carrying a shopping bag full of food. She prepared the food for the kids and I. I didn't know her. I didn't recognize this woman. But she took my hand and said, "You might remember my husband. He died a few years ago." Her last name, Elnagar, finally registered in my mind, and I responded, "Of course, Osh, I remember." So this woman, a stranger, was here in our home, offering herself to me as someone who doesn't know me, but someone who knows this sharp, annihilating pain. And then, during the visitation hours last night, Larry Maddox greeted me, overcome by the echoes of his own familiar grief, feeling all that agony again, but holding himself in front of me nonetheless like a gift of kinship. The sky is blueing, and soon the morning darkness will fade into daylight. I'm going to put on my shoes and go walk by the river. My heart beats a song, a mournful, patient song with only one line: "Where are you?" in search of the life I lost 5 days ago. I know I cannot get it back, but perhaps I'll find a remnant or an echo of its passing, and maybe that will be enough for today. Perhaps Naomi was in search of a similar remnant when she returned to Bethlehem. In spite of her bitterness, maybe she still carried an unreasonable hope that she could find some remnant of her old life. I carried similar hopes for weeks. Every time the telephone rang late in the afternoon, during that time when Troy would have been driving home from work, I hoped it might be him calling to tell me everything was a mistake and he'd be home soon. I don't know what Naomi's expectations were, but whatever they were, Ruth's intentions are very clear in this narrative. Where you go, I will go. Your God will be my God. Ruth had her own losses to grieve. She was a widow, too. But she chose to grieve them not in isolation, but in the presence of another woman who knows. I have precise memories of the night Troy died. The vacant, detached expression in his eyes, his skin becoming mottled in blue, the sudden motion and energy of paramedics in my house. But those visual memories occur within an auditory vacuum, as if I had suddenly lost my sense of hearing. For months, I was convinced that I had also lost my ability to appreciate beauty or to feel hope. I remember telling my closest friends the day after he died that I was certain I would never read or write poetry again. Philosopher Simone Weil insists that only two things pierce the armored human heart, beauty and affliction. Having experienced the wound of affliction, I was sure that the shimmering beauty of the poetry I'd always loved would be the final fatal blow, or worse, that the poetry I loved would be nothing more than meaningless babble to which I was permanently deaf. Here's an excerpt from another letter dated a few months later, December 9th. I am functioning well publicly, but right this moment I can hardly see or breathe past the terrible pain in my chest. I keep thinking of a scene from a movie I saw once in which a person suffered public execution. A woman was strapped to the ground on her back, and an elephant stood over her. On the executioner's command, the elephant raised itself onto its hind legs like a circus animal performing a trick, and then brought the full, violent weight of its four legs down onto the woman, crushing her to death. I find myself strapped down this morning. The mammoth shadow of your death hovering over me, elephantine and obedient, both of us waiting for the executioner's signal. And even as I cry out, what are you waiting for? Just end it, please. I remember the psalm. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. For thou art with me, thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. I am terrified, Troy. But I know this pain will not destroy me. God is my Redeemer, and He will bear the full weight of death to keep me alive. This is also true. A person cannot witness the death of another human being and be outside the presence of God. Soon after you died, I witnessed the merciful glory of God passing through our home in all the care and the gifts of friends. But I understand now that I stood in the presence of God that night when your heart shuddered and stopped. He accompanied you. He sustained me. My favorite scene in the book of Ruth is that moment when Boaz acknowledges Ruth's request for marriage and restores her to a state of fullness. He treats her with tenderness and respect, protecting her integrity, and promising to honor her with his actions among the men in that community. And then he extends a gesture of profound mercy. He asks Ruth to spread her shawl her only covering in the absence of a husband or father. And Boaz fills it with grain. Yet we miss the significance of that gift of grain, if we ignore the act of submission that precedes it. Ruth goes to the threshing floor, lays herself at the feet of Boaz, and covers both of them. And then she waits for him to find her. Humility and submission like that are excruciating sacrifices when you're barely holding your life together. In the months that followed Troy's death, I resumed a full-time teaching schedule, as some of you witnessed, and I kept our daily lives turning. Like Ruth, I gleaned among the wreckage of an old dream in order to keep my family alive. Every day through the fall and winter, I chanted a mantra to keep myself focused on what was in front of me rather than what lay strewn behind me. Keep breathing and do the next thing. Keep breathing and do the next thing. I whispered it like a prayer every time I found myself on the cusp of panic or emotional paralysis. Keep breathing and do the next thing. Maybe Ruth whispered those same words as she followed the harvesters each day and then returned to Naomi with her meager daily portions. The mantra worked for me until the shock and numbness wore off. In February, I started to feel again. I became angry. So, I had the first of many persistent arguments with God. One Sunday evening, I surveyed the breadth of the week in front of me and thought about the weight of all of the responsibilities I had to bear. And I said no. Throwing both hands in the air, I said to God, I'm finished. I cannot do this again. I can't teach my classes, get the kids to their activities, pay the bills, make the meals, do the laundry, attend meetings. I cannot do this for another week. And here's how God responded to me. He listened patiently without rebuke. He didn't say, oh, come on, buck up and go on. I've given you what you need to get through the day, so get to it. He did not rebuke me like that. Quietly, as if he was sitting on the bed beside me, his arm around my shoulders, he said, okay, I won't ask you for another week. I'll ask you for only one day. Can you get through Monday? Can you trust me to sustain you through Monday? Because I know my God is tender and he is good, I agreed, but reluctantly and with my teeth gritted. I carried more dread than faith into that week. And then Monday evening, when I threw my hands in the air again and said, I can't do this alone anymore, he urged me tenderly, you aren't alone. Can you do only those things I am calling you to do on Tuesday? The argument would fade as the week progressed, but every Sunday night, I would have the same argument with God, and every Sunday night, he answered me the same way. Can you trust me to sustain you through Monday? Well, that worked from February to April. And then Holy Week opened like a cave in front of me. My children were on spring break, so suddenly I didn't have the structure and the demand of their daily routines to keep me in motion. So having no strength or hope of my own, I lay down in that cave and waited to be swallowed alive by despair. I really thought it would devour me. For 5 days, I came to this campus only long enough to teach my classes, and then I went home and went to bed, neglecting my children, letting them feed themselves. I lay in that cave waiting to die. And because God is merciful, he waited tenderly beside me and offered me a kind of death and resurrection, not of my physical body, but a resurrection of my faith in him and of my hope in life. By Easter Sunday, I stood before the risen Christ like Ruth standing before Boaz. my cloak of mourning spread empty before him. I cannot explain what changed over the course of that week, certainly not my circumstances. There was very little different between Sunday morning and the prior Monday afternoon. But graciously, when I stood empty before the Lord, he filled my shawl with the bread of life. Some days I still chant that mantra all day long. Keep breathing and do the next thing. Keep breathing and do the next thing. But the mantra is not what saves me or gives me hope. Whenever I am overwhelmed by grief or nearly blind with anger, gratitude brings me back to what is true. Gratitude brings me back to what is beautiful, and gratitude brings me back to what is holy. I would not have chosen the devastating change that tore my life apart a year ago. But now, I would not forfeit even one of the holy moments that have marked my life since Troy's death. My experience this past year has taught me that God's provision honors the sacrifices of those who give generously to those in desperate need. And his provision restores the needy to fullness. Boaz gives out of abundance, abundance of grain, abundance of compassion, abundance of integrity. And he is honored as a figure in the genealogy of Christ. Stripped of every resource and protection, Ruth submits herself to a kinsman redeemer and is restored to fullness as a wife, as a mother, and as a member of that community. Repeatedly, God met my needs by prompting the people at Anderson University, at Eastside Church of God, people in my friendship circle, to give out of their own abundance. One of my students brought me a piece of fresh fruit every single day of the fall semester. She tracked me down if she didn't have me in class that day, brought me peaches and pomegranates and grapes. My children's pastor brought me a thick envelope of $1 bills so I would have lunch money for my kids and not have to scrounge around to try to get the right change. Two friends dug up one corner of my yard and buried tulip and daffodil bulbs in secret as a surprise, so that I would be delighted and surprised by that sudden burst of color in the spring. They didn't know it, but what they were planting, what they were participating in, was the resurrection of my belief in beauty and my willingness to submit to it again. Four men from my church replaced the roof on my garage because it was rotten and about to collapse. Troy and I had begun to repair it, but we weren't finished, so they completed that task for me. My Bible study friends filled my cupboards and freezer with food so that I wouldn't have to walk into the grocery store and try to manage those aisles, overwhelmed by the thought of feeding my children for the rest of their lives. This is how Christ saves us. Bereft and weary, we hold open our sorrow and emptiness, and Christ fills us with the bread of life. I told you I'm grateful to be before you today, and I am. This opportunity feels providential and sacred because 5 days from today, my children and I will pass the first anniversary of Troy's death. Our loss is great, but our blessings are many because the kinsman redeemer has thrown down his sandal and spoken for us. My children and I may be a widow and three orphans, but we are not forsaken. In A Grief Observed, C.S. Lewis distinguishes grief from mourning. He says, in grief, nothing stays put. One keeps emerging from a phase, but it always recurs round and round. Perhaps we never stop grieving a person we love, we've lost, because grief arises from love, and love endures far beyond that terrible threshold death makes in our lives. My heart will break every time I pass a family milestone. My daughter's 18th birthday, my youngest son's graduation, my oldest son's wedding. But I will miss those moments entirely if I drape them in mourning clothes. Lewis also observes that the less he mourned his wife, the nearer he seemed to her. I want to live in a way that keeps Troy near, not bury him every single day. few weeks ago, I packed my husband's beautiful shirts, suits, silk ties, all of his shoes, and he did have a beautiful collection of those things. I packed those into rubber tubs for storage until my boys become men who can wear them. The next day, I weeded my flower beds and strung colored lights above the patio garden to make that place beautiful. There is life in both gestures. I chose life when I traveled to France last March to celebrate my 40th birthday with my best friend, but without my husband. I chose life when I painted the walls in Troy's home office an outrageous, awful orange. But I did it so I could claim that space for myself. I chose life when I took my children to Disney World in May by myself. And I chose life when I scheduled to have new family portraits made of just the four of us. My extended family also chose life when, in obedience to my decision to have Troy cremated and not purchase a cemetery plot at Maplewood, we planted a tree on campus and dedicated a plaque at the base of that tree so that he is here, so that we can remember him in a place where he came into adulthood, where he discovered what his life would be and who he would be in that life. In the third act of Our Town, Thornton Wilder speculates that the dead are no longer concerned with the affairs of the living. Rather, they're waiting while the earthly part is burned away, waiting for the eternal, held dormant and bone deep and secret, to arise. I see in Thornton Wilder's play a translation for redemption. Despite the enemy's efforts to seize creation, God is taking it back. He's taking us back, one detail at a time. So redemption happens in increments as all those fractured pieces of our lives, including the losses and disappointments, are reunited with our Maker. When our Savior calls us back to that lovely garden in which we were created, we will have the full sight and knowledge of the redeemed, not the limited vision of our earthly bodies. I cannot predict or imagine what heaven will be, but I do like to imagine two things. When I need a chuckle, I imagine that he goes shoe shopping with Linda Cummins every Saturday afternoon. And when I'm missing him desperately and I need encouragement, I like to imagine that Troy will meet me there on a spectacularly beautiful fall day like the one on which he left me. And he'll say, "Welcome home. I missed you. Tell me everything." And he won't ask because he doesn't know how I've lived every moment of my life since he died. He'll ask because there will be so much joy for all of us in the telling. Thank you for your compassionate attention. May the peace which passes all understanding, that mysterious, unfathomable peace that has sustained and healed me this year, be with you.